Welcome back to City Views on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Can LGBT rights be gained only at the expense of religious liberty? That's the question Clifford Roski, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Utah and Senior Research Fellow at UCLA's Williams Institute, is exploring. It's an issue that's been raised by social conservatives in the state following the passage of several non-discrimination ordinances for the gay and transgender community in more than a dozen Utah cities and counties. Roski will speak tomorrow night at 7:30 at Westminster College as part of the Bastion Foundation Diversity Lecture Series. But first, he joins me now in the studio to talk about navigating between religious liberties and LGBT rights. And Cliff, it's good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jeff. It's good to be here.
Listeners, join us on the air with your questions and comments. How can LGBT rights be won without infringing on religious liberty, especially in a conservative state like Utah? Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Well, Cliff, when did you first start studying the conflict between LGBT rights and religious liberty, and what attracted you to this particular conflict?
Well, religious liberties was not something on my mind when I came here to teach law. I was working in San Francisco at the time, and I had an opportunity to come and teach at the University of Utah Law School. But as soon as I got here, the LDS Church entered the campaign to pass Proposition 8. And before long, I started to see an opportunity to show both sides that there was common ground, because the church announced that it supported employment, housing, inheritance, and health care rights that already existed in California for same-sex couples, but none of those rights existed in Utah.
And so the conflict, though, between gay rights and religious liberty started, obviously, way before Proposition 8, I'm sure. When did we start to see this conflict really emerge in this country? Was it during the 1990s? Was it even earlier, perhaps?
Well, in fact, the conflict between homosexual behavior and religion goes back much further, all the way to the Middle Ages. But in the United States, I think it's most closely associated with the late 1970s. The gay rights movement in its modern form took off in the late 60s and gained a lot of ground in the 70s, some very significant victories. In particular, homosexuality was no longer listed as a mental illness by psychiatrists. And then in the late 70s, Anita Bryant launched what was known as her Save Our Children campaign, in which she argued that gay teachers in Florida were molesting and recruiting children into homosexuality. And she often cited Bible verses to back up her claims.
One case that you'll be discussing is that of Christian Legal Society v. UC Hastings, a public law school in California. Before we get to the ruling in the case, take us through the circumstances. What exactly did this involve here? Who were the plaintiffs?
The plaintiffs were a group of students at this law school, which is part of the University of California system, and they were forming a group called the Christian Legal Society. And the problem they had was they wanted to be recognized and funded as an official school group, but they didn't want to admit openly gay students.
And so did the university tell them they couldn't do that?
Yes, the university had a rule that said that all student groups, in order to be recognized, had to accept all comers. That is, any student who wanted to be a member of the group had to be admitted.
So this case eventually made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, if I'm not wrong. What happened there?
Well, the students lost and the school won. And the reason was, in situations like this where students are trying to form a group, the Supreme Court has long held that the school must have reasonable and neutral policies. And this all-comers policy is the classic neutral policy. That is, the Republican club has to admit Democrats, the Democrats have to admit Republicans, the gay students have to admit Christians, the Christian students have to admit gays. So it was clear that it was a neutral policy, and the school had not adopted it simply to discriminate against a religious group.
So what's your opinion, based on your study of the Constitution, your research, about whether the organization's religious liberties were violated by not being allowed to bar gay students from joining?
I think it's very clear that the Supreme Court was right in that case, and that the group's religious rights were not infringed. That case has a long history as well, also coming out of the late 60s. In the 70s, gay students started forming organizations on college campuses, and they were often denied official recognition. And courts uniformly held that they had the right to form those organizations. And then in the 80s, the same principle was applied to religious groups. When campuses barred religious groups from meeting on campus, The Supreme Court struck that down. And then a law called the Equal Access Act was passed. And it's a nice law because the title tells you exactly what's going on. Schools have to give equal access to all groups. That is gay groups, religious groups, groups of any kind. As long as they follow reasonable and neutral rules, students can form whatever group they like.
This is City Views on KCBW. My guest is Clifford Roski, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Utah and Senior Research Fellow at the Williams Institute at UCLA. He'll speak tomorrow night at 7:30 at Westminster College as part of the Bastion Foundation Diversity Lecture Series. Well, Cliff, here in Utah, we've seen 14 cities and counties pass non-discrimination ordinances that bar people from discriminating against the LGBT community in employment and in housing. We've seen conservative groups like the Sutherland Institute and the Eagle Forum claim that these infringe on religious liberty if you happen to think that homosexuality is sinful, but you sharply disagree. Explain what your thinking is on that issue and why these particular ordinances are not an infringement upon religious liberty.
Well, I think one has to distinguish between a person's religious beliefs and their religious practice and what they do when they go out into the public sphere as an employer or as a landlord. And it's not just me who believes this. One of the reasons I think it's fair to say that 14 cities and counties now have these laws is that the first speaker at the first hearing in Salt Lake City when the law was passed was a representative of the LDS Church. And what he said was that while the church is, opposed to same-sex marriage, it supports employment and housing rights because they're basic human rights, the right to keep a roof over your head and the right to pay your rent, and they had nothing to do with marriage. And in particular, the church said that the law balanced religious freedoms of individuals against the basic rights of gay and transgender people. And I agree with that. I think that it's clear in this country that different rules apply when you are renting four or more apartments or running a significant size business with more than 15 employees, that you have to play by reasonable and neutral rules like everyone else.
What about the cases we've seen in other states, Cliff, where, for example, a wedding photographer who refuses to photograph a same-sex wedding, says she only photographs traditional weddings, is sued? What are your thoughts on that case? It seems like, for example, the non-discrimination policy that governs, cases where you refuse a service to somebody, you refuse to give them employment. This seems to be a case where, you're refusing a specific service. What are your thoughts on whether people can be required to perform such services and whether that infringes on their religious liberty?
I think that's an excellent question. These are known as public accommodations laws. That is, if you open your business to the public, then you can't discriminate based on certain characteristics. And I do think this is the place where conflicts between religious liberties and gay rights are most likely to occur and have occurred in some other states. A couple things are important to note about the relevance of those conflicts in Utah. One is they all involve same-sex marriage or civil unions, and those things are already prohibited by the Utah Constitution. So those conflicts in particular are not likely to arise in Utah at all unless we re-amend our Constitution. And the other point is that those conflicts really have nothing at all to do with employment or housing. That is, it's not about whether someone should be fired or evicted because they're gay or transgender, but whether they should be served. Now, personally, what do I think about these laws? I think they're good laws. I think that it's an important principle that if you're out in the public sphere and you open your business to the public, that you should be willing to serve all customers, because I think that there's something uniquely humiliating about being turned away simply because of who you are. But I understand that, reasonable minds may disagree on this, and that's a conversation I'm excited to have. I think what we need here most of all is for both sides to put aside their differences and just start talking to each other in a civil and respectful manner and figure out not what we want, but what we need in order to get along in the world and to thrive.
One important Supreme Court case that deals with the conflict between gay rights and religious liberty comes from Colorado. This is Romer v. Evans of 1996, which you have written about. What did this case involve?
So this was a case in which a few cities in the state of Colorado had passed non-discrimination ordinances, much like Salt Lake City's, and it looked like the Colorado legislature was in a position to pass such a law. But there was a ballot initiative put on the ballot known as Amendment 2, and that law repealed all of the local non-discrimination ordinances and then barred any city or the state from passing a similar law in the future. So as a result, it really denied gay people as a group equal protection of the law. It said that you couldn't pass a law to protect gay or bisexual people in particular. And the court said that that was unconstitutional. The United States Supreme Court did. That it was the very essence of what it meant to deny a group equal protection of the law, to single them out and say, you cannot be protected by our laws.
Do you think that that ruling then paved the way for the ruling we've seen from Judge Vaughn Walker in California, the federal case overturning Proposition 8 as unconstitutional?
I think that that's part of what paved the way for that ruling. There's also another case known as Lawrence versus Texas, in which the United States Supreme Court struck down a sodomy law. And there, in particular, the court explicitly said that simply because the majority of people believe that a practice is immoral or sinful is not a reasonable, neutral basis for supporting a law. And I think when you put those two cases together, you get at least the principle behind Judge Vaughn Walker's ruling.
What do you think is coming next in Proposition 8? Do you see the U.S. Supreme Court taking up this matter, and what's on the horizon in the next couple of years for this conflict you've studied between religious liberty and LGBT rights?
Well, I think the next, currently the sponsors of Proposition 8 have appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which is a court in between the trial court and the United States Supreme Court. They've already got a ruling from the Ninth Circuit, but that was only from three judges out of, I think, 28. And so now they're appealing to the broader group to see if they'll disagree with it. I think personally that it's unlikely that the broader group will disagree with the ruling. And so then they'll go up to the United States Supreme Court. I think it would likely be in next year, not this year. And it's really anyone's guess. It's hard to think of a closer call for whether the court would accept the petition here. Because the Ninth Circuit has ruled very narrowly that only Proposition 8 is unconstitutional and not all laws against same-sex marriage, they may actually just ignore this case and wait for a bigger case.
We've been speaking with University of Utah Associate Professor of Law Clifford Roski. He is also a senior research fellow at the Williams Institute at UCLA. Tomorrow night at 7:30, he'll speak at the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College as part of the Bastion Foundation Diversity Lecture Series. Clifford, thank you very much for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
This is City Views on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Listen to podcasts of the show online at kcbw.org. Our theme music was composed by Ryan Cron, and thank you to Jesse Ellis for his help with the program.